Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. It's more important than ever to organize a multiracial working class resistance to demand a better world for us all, always putting in the front of the struggles the cries for racial justice that echoed around the globe in the wake of the police murder of George Floyd. It is for us to pick up George Floyd's 6-year-old daughter Gianna's challenge, Daddy, change the world and make it so.
In this light, Dr. William Darity Jr., whose research is devoted to inequality in the context of race, which includes the economics of black reparations, joins us to tackle the wealth gap, a legacy of the inequality of the system of plantation capitalism to now.
I want to start with the issue of wealth and structural racism, because there's still that bifurcation. What comes first, race or class? There really is, as we move with the cry for racial justice, to separate out the social issues as though somehow they are disconnected with the disparity of wealth, that you don't need both to be able to realize equal rights and justice. Let's start with that. The imperative of understanding the disparity, the wealth gap for people of African ancestry in this society.
Wealth inequality is outrageously high between all Americans, but there is a difference that has to be charted between general wealth inequality and wealth inequality that's based on race. Why do I say that there's a difference? There's a difference in the degree of wealth that is lower among black Americans than there is among white Americans. If we were to look at the poorest white and black Americans, those individuals whose income levels are in the bottom 20% of the nation's distribution, we would find that white households actually have a median level of wealth that is equivalent to the median level of wealth held by all black households in the United States. So this is somewhere in the vicinity of $17,000 to $18,000. The median level of wealth for blacks in the lowest 20% of the income distribution, the lowest, is actually closer to zero. So even when we're looking at the very poorest individuals who are black and white in the United States, there's a wealth differential. And if we were to go to the upper end of the distribution, about one quarter of all white households have a net worth in excess of $1 million, while it's only 4% of all black households. These circumstances translate into a condition where the average net worth between a black and white household differs by approximately $840,000. There's a highly uneven distribution of wealth across all Americans, but when we look at the racial difference in wealth, it's far more intense and aggravated. We also know that the pandemic has placed a heavy burden on many families in terms of additional expenses that they've been confronted with, particularly if they have lost jobs or if they have had family members who have developed the disease. And to the extent that there's been a higher mortality rate and a higher infection rate among black Americans than white Americans, that means that there's an expense burden that has probably been greater for black Americans. And that may put downward pressure on the capacity of those families to maintain whatever limited wealth position they already had.
In terms of the disparity of both wealth and income, and exacerbated by the pandemic, Dr. King was talking about a very similar thing back in the year or two before he was assassinated, the wealth disparity and the income disparity. And he was talking about job guarantees and income guarantees. I know recently you've talked about job guarantees. Would you want to talk a little bit more about that?
The job guarantee, I think, is a very important policy, but I want to emphasize that the job guarantee is a way of maintaining and supporting people's income, but it probably would have very little effect on their wealth position. The job guarantee in short form is the idea that every American adult would be able to obtain employment through the public sector. The public sector would always assure that they would have an employment opportunity at a job that would provide them with a compensation that would be above the poverty level and also would include a benefits package that would be the equivalent of the package that is available to all federal civil servants. So this would be inclusive of health insurance. The premise here is that we would eliminate unemployment in the United States. In addition, it would mean that we would also establish a floor for the compensation that all American workers could receive, because the existence of this public option for employment would set the terms that the private sector would have to meet to hire anyone at all. And so this is a way in which we could effectively establish a minimum wage or a living wage that would apply to all workers, not just workers who are employed, but also workers who might be subjected to unemployment in the absence of a federal job guarantee. In addition, a conventional minimum wage does not provide people with an assurance that they will have a sufficient number of hours of work to qualify for benefits. So again, the existence of a federal job guarantee at non-poverty wages with a good benefits package really, really would alter the terrain. And if we had had such an arrangement in place at the onset of the pandemic, folks whose jobs were eliminated as a consequence of the health dangers associated with personal contact would have had an opportunity to move directly onto the public sector payroll.
How do you look at the kind of condition where the African-American population is in terms of being able to advance the calls either for a meaningful system of employment and or to beginning to deal with and institutionalize or dismantle white supremacy as a major maintainer of the disparity in wealth?
The Black American effort to improve the community's economic and social standing has largely been linked to education. And that's in large measure because education has been the only significant avenue for upward mobility that has been available to Black Americans. And in fact, we have a situation now where young Black Americans are more likely to acquire more years of schooling and more credentials than young white Americans who are from families or households that have similar levels of income. So if we were to take into account family income, Black students are more likely to continue in school longer, to obtain more degrees, and to acquire more training than comparably situated younger white Americans. And I think that this is in large measure because there are more opportunities available to younger white Americans as a consequence of the fact that their families generally have a much better wealth position than young Black Americans. One of the consequences of this pursuit of higher education, I mean, this determined pursuit of higher education, has been a circumstance in which many younger Black Americans have accumulated a significant amount of student debt, because their parents do not have the capacity to support them in obtaining higher education in the same way as many younger white Americans. And so there's almost a two-edged sword here. On the one hand, there's the opportunities that are associated with getting higher earnings and higher income as a consequence of additional educational attainment. But there's also the greater burden of having to take on additional amounts of student debt to be able to negotiate the higher education process. But there is an issue that is associated with what resources individuals have or what resources their families have. And that's the gulf that is a consequence of the nation's racial history and its racial present. And I think what's significant about the George Floyd moment is that it brought to light for all Americans, a long-standing pattern of anti-black police violence on the part of the nation's law enforcement agencies. What does that mean in terms of the racial wealth gap? I think George Floyd's tragic death, his murder, has led people to examine a wider range of disparities that extend beyond the practices of the of our nation's police forces. And from that standpoint, it's led us to shine a light on a host of arenas in which unequal life between black and whites in the United States.
Shining the light on, especially with regard to not only income, but wealth. In addition to reparations, what kinds of policies might be followed to address that racial wealth gap?
The racial wealth gap has to be addressed by making direct payments to black Americans who are descendants of persons enslaved in the United States. Direct payments of a sufficient amount that they would build the black asset position to a level that would be at least comparable to the asset position that is held by white Americans. I've long thought that that's the appropriate way to think about what a reparations plan should do, that it should directly address the racial wealth gap and address it in such a way that it's eliminated. But I don't think that there's any other significant way of eliminating the racial wealth gap besides this direct type of strategy. Indirect approaches or universal programs will not turn the trick in terms of eliminating the racial wealth gap.
There's certainly been some affirmative move amongst some number of Democrats who have gone back and looked at the House Resolution number 40, which was the number chosen by Representative John Conyers, as he referred to it, as a broken government promise to provide 40 acres and a mule to freed slaves at the end of the Civil War. Now, Sheila Jackson Lee and other people, Maxine Waters, have been prominent in moving that along now. But how do you, since that is essentially a committee to study the issue, how do you see moving that along?
Well, first, let me say that at the same time that the freedmen were denied the 40-acre land grants that they were pledged as restitution, the United States government was giving 1.5 million white families 160-acre land grants in the Western Territories under the terms of the Homestead Act. So they were providing those families with a strong boost in terms of asset building while they were denying the formerly enslaved any initial asset as they emerged from their period of bondage. So the motivation for calling it H.R. 40 is extremely attractive. However, I have some very strong reservations about H.R. 40, the specifics of this particular piece of legislation, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the key point I want to make is that as a matter of principle, having a commission that would be responsible for designing a plan of reparations in advance of congressional vote on such proposals is entirely sensible. It's precisely what took place before the Japanese American reparations plan was put into operation by Congress. There was a commission known as the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians that generated a report in 1982 that was the basis for congressional action that resulted in the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 that provided direct payments as compensation to the Japanese Americans who had been subjected to unjust incarceration during the course of World War II. So as a matter of principle, a study commission is not a bad idea. There is an existing alternative, which I think is a very positive one, that's been introduced by Representative Barbara Lee from California, which is to establish a truth commission, which would engage in a series of hearings. It would evaluate the historical record with respect to racial atrocities in the United States. It would reconfigure and provide us with an accurate story about what occurred under slavery, what occurred during the Civil War, what occurred in Reconstruction, as an alternative to many of the false narratives that have been circulating for many years as a consequence of the influence of the Daughters of the American Revolution and the United Daughters of the Confederacy on our school curriculum in particular. So I think that some form of a commission is a good one, is a good idea. But I think that the law that H.R. 40 represents, or the bill H.R. 40, has some serious defects and leads me to have strong reservations about using it as a mechanism for trying to get from here to there. What are those defects? Well, the first one I would highlight is that the version of the bill that came out of the markup session that was held at the House Judiciary Committee has a provision that the Federal Advisory Committee Act is not applicable to the commission. And the Federal Advisory Committee Act is the piece of legislation that ensures that commission or committee proceedings would be transparent, that there would be open meetings, that there would be hearings, and there would be public reporting of the committee's deliberations and decisions, or the commission's deliberations and decisions. And so that is ruled out as an obligation or responsibility of the commission. The second concern that I have is the fact that the legislation provides salaries for the members of the commission at the executive four level on the federal pay scale. And I went back and examined what an executive four level of salary would be, and it amounts to up to $172,000 per annum. I think it's entirely inappropriate for members of a commission that would have the mission of designing proposals for reparations for Black Americans to be paid salaries. I certainly think that it's a good idea for the commissioners' expenses that they might incur in the process of serving, that those expenses should be reimbursed, but they should not be paid salaries for performing this national service. There should be a paid professional staff to assist the commissioners, but the commissioners themselves should not receive these salaries. I think that there's a high degree of impropriety associated with doing that. And I would add, two-thirds of congressional commissions do not pay their members anything whatsoever. And then a final consideration that I'd like to bring to light about weaknesses in the legislation is the fact that the law has been progressively changed over the years in terms of the numbers of individuals who could be on the commission. First, it was seven when John Conyers first introduced the legislation. Then circa 2017, 2018, it was raised to 13 members. And now it is 15 members. And this seems to be an incredibly unwieldy number. And the rationale for the increase is not at all clear. So I think that there's some structural flaws with the legislation. And one last point I'll make is that the current form of the legislation specifies that a quorum would be 7 out of 15 members, which is less than a majority of the commission's members. And this is really unusual from my standpoint. So there's some very quirky elements of the law itself as it's currently written that I think need to be addressed. I think I'm one of the few people who's a passionate advocate of reparations, but is not a supporter of H.R. 40.
Just to divert from that for a moment, the issue of child tax credits, that as a kind of beginning remedial component to the wealth gap that the tax credit that has gone into effect. Is that something that you would advocate for? And then what should be the policy positions that we take to begin to deal with this a strategic part of the maintenance of a white supremacist system?
I'm very skeptical about tax credits being the solution. Tax credits are tied to people's income levels. So black and white Americans start out with very different income levels. I mean, the disparity in income is not as great as the disparity in wealth, but it is substantial. The average black household has an income level in the vicinity of $35,000 to $40,000, while the average white household has an income level in the vicinity of $60,000 to $65,000. And so tax credits are usually calibrated on the basis of your income. And so the lower your income, the lower the amount that you're going to get in the form of the tax credit. And in fact, for individuals whose incomes are too low for them to have a tax obligation under a tax credit system, unless you design it as a negative income tax, they're really not going to get much of anything. So I view tax credits as a way of augmenting or supplementing people's incomes, but I don't see it as a mechanism for addressing the enormous wealth disparity in the United States. How would I address that enormous wealth disparity? Well, as I said, the way you close the racial wealth gap is by closing the racial wealth gap. And in our book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, we say that the federal government should expend a sufficient amount of funds to bridge the differential in wealth between black and white Americans. Black Americans who have ancestors who were enslaved in the United States constitute about 12% of the nation's population, but possess less than 2% of the nation's wealth. And so our objective should be to bring the black share of wealth into conformity with the black share of the population. Black Americans should have at least 12% of the nation's wealth, would require an expenditure of approximately $11 trillion. If we are serious about closing the racial wealth gap, that's the type of commitment that has to be made.
What is your position on a negative income tax or other means of providing income to households on some kind of a sliding scale?
So I'm not opposed to that. You know, the only point I was trying to make that's really central to this is that we cannot think about that as a means of reducing the wealth gap. But certainly it's a means of mitigating some degrees of income inequality. To the extent that it's a policy that's applied to all Americans, whether black, white, Asian, Latino, or of some other ethnicity, whether if it's a universal program, then it's going to have less of an effect on reducing income differences by race. But that doesn't mean that it's not a desirable policy at all. I'm in favor of a variety of ways in which we might supplement people's incomes. I would be quite receptive to a guaranteed income strategy where a negative income tax is one way of trying to do that. But I think that the central policy that the federal government should pursue to support people's incomes is a federal job guarantee.
Lastly, the issue of organizing for these. I wonder to what extent you've thought about the issue of when workers are bargaining for around the contracts for increase and so on. To what extent do you think that the organized labor movement has an obligation to begin to peg its bargaining demands to issues that deal with the wealth disparity? And most decidedly, when many of the industrial sectors and retail sectors have a predominantly black workforce. Have you thought about that at all as a way of trying to implement the concepts that you have described so vividly and put.
So I'm an advocate of two different types of policies. I think that they are both policies that must be embraced by the United States for the purposes of creating a more just and equitable America. The one set of policies are policies that would address inequality in general, particularly income inequality. I've referred to that in conjunction with work that I've done with Mark Paul and Derek Hamilton. We've referred to that as an economic bill of rights for the 21st century. And this would include a set of policies like a federal job guarantee, which would actually enhance the bargaining position of the unions because it would eliminate the prospect of unemployment altogether. Employers could not use the threat of unemployment as part of their negotiating position with respect to processes of mediation between them and the unions. That's the first dimension of an economic bill of rights for the 21st century. A second dimension is the provision of national health insurance for all Americans, a single-payer plan. A third provision is an assurance of decent housing for everyone. A fourth provision is public banking, postal banking, being made available to all Americans. This would be a mechanism for eliminating predatory lending altogether. Postal banking, public banking system could provide a set of services at low cost to all American citizens in such a way that you could drive out of existence predatory lenders. One of the other things that we have increasingly been saying should be a right of citizenship is access to Wi-Fi services, broadband services, at no cost to individuals. That's a set of packages that I think would be extremely helpful in addressing overall class inequality in the United States. But that does not address racial differences, and it does not address racial wealth differences. So as a consequence, we need to have a reparations plan that's designed in such a way that it eliminates the racial wealth gap.
And so that encourages me even further to tell our listeners, from here to equality, reparations for Black Americans in the 21st century, with his co-author, Professor Darity's co-author, Kirsten Mullen, is a must-read. And most significantly, it's a must-read because the ideas are strategic to implement. And I want to thank you with that for spending the time with us. It's always enormously productive and enlightening to speak with you. We've been speaking with Professor William Darity, Jr., and a must-read is his newest book, From Here to Equality. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're building bridges to the workers of the world. Stay strong, stay well. And educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.